All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of the Meat Mafia podcast. This is a Meat Mafia Moments. This is when we go back in time throughout the history of the podcast and bring you the best episodes, clips from the best episodes that we've ever done. In today's episode, I'm really excited to share because I truly believe that this is kind of like the manifesto for the Meat Mafia, what's talked about in this 27-minute clip. And it's with our good friend, Jay Guilanello, who has done a ton of research on food history and what's happening behind the scenes to change and alter what we believe to be food and how we actually think about food. And there's really a lot of political interest involved with this, and that's what Jay gets into. So we're going to talk about Rockefeller, the Flexner Report. We're going to talk a good amount about C40 cities, which is a growing concern, and I hope you guys do your own research on that. This is a phenomenal podcast, and Jay is just a wealth of knowledge. So without further ado, Jay Guilanello.
Have you done any digging on like the Flexner Report and how that impacted Western medicine? And,
sure.
And the reason why I'm saying that is we started off just writing informational threads on nutrition, kind of telling some of these stories similar to what you do about like why the food system is the way that it is. And I remember stumbling upon like Rockefeller and Carnegie's impact in creating the Flexner Report.
Yeah.
And if you're comfortable with it, if you want to talk through that, that is a fascinating story.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, you're talking about the homogenization of all medical schools and the complete destruction of the empirics, the homeopaths, you know, everything that was thought to be alternative, even though when you think about it, the current model of the petrochemical, that current model of practice is actually the experiment, because that's only really been around for a little over 100 years. When the rest of these modalities, and so again, what I'm trying to say is I think we should be combining everything. I think yes. There's a place for everything. Like trauma care, I mean, there's no better place or time that I would rather live, than right here at this time if I was ever in a catastrophic accident and Western medicine had to put me back together.
100%.
No other time. They are brilliant at that. I have a friend who's an ER nurse, and the things that she tells me that she's able to do because of her training and because of the advancements in medicine, I would never want to give that up.
Yes.
But, and it's a big but, is that there's a whole other side. We talked about prevention. And a lot of that stuff, because of the Flexner Report, which essentially closed, I don't want to say two-thirds, but it was a large portion of medical schools because they didn't meet this sort of standard, this Rockefeller medicine standard, which was we're going to use chemicals to manage symptoms. Mm-hmm. But back at that time, people had a choice whether they wanted to go with sort of allopathic medicine or sort of empirical medicine and work with the empirics. And most people didn't want to deal with allopathic medicine because the side effects were so terrible. And so again, I'm all about choice. People that follow me and that read the work, I only want to present information and then say, listen, make your own choice.
Yes.
With nutrition, with medicine, with everything. Informed consent. Mm-hmm. As long as people have that, then I'm totally happy with whatever choice they make. Because I figure eventually people will get there. The true free market will decide. But that's what the Flexner Report did, was essentially, and if you read the Flexner Report, it's very interesting. Abraham Flexner had a serious bias going in. And when you're paid by the Rockefellers and the Carnegies to, the outcome that you get is not surprising when you're paid by the entities mm-hmm. that want a certain outcome. That's just human nature.
Yeah.
That report was not going to come out and say, everything's fine.
100%.
Never going to happen. So, I think, again, and nothing is all one way. Nothing is all bad or all good. I mean, it certainly did help establish some sort of level of, credential for medical institutions and universities. But it also completely abolished almost. And in fact, it was sort of responsible for the whole quack term, right? Everybody who didn't practice Rockefeller style medicine was considered a quack. And that's wrong. That's just wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think we're suffering. I think now it's taken a long time for us to really understand just how poor that paradigm is. Mm-hmm. And I think now we're starting to realize it. I mean, the last 3 years we've seen what happens when you squash dissent. And you just have one way of practicing and bad things happen. Bad things happen. So,
and our health is a reflection of that. And I think the backstory, right? So Rockefeller owns Standard Oil, biggest oil conglomerate the world has ever seen. They realized, to your point, that you could take these petrochemicals and actually turn them into synthetic pills, supplements, vitamins, things like that. Mm-hmm. And him and Carnegie essentially funded this Flexner Report, which was going to be the benchmark and gold standard for all medicine moving forward. Yes. So to your point, all these allopathic practices were deemed as quacks versus everything that kind of fit this pharmacological source of medicine was deemed as like the gold standard.
Yes.
And to what you're saying, I think part of the issue that the alternative health community makes is that they view it as a very binary thing where it's like all in on preventative alternative medicine,
right.
No space for pharmacology. And what you're saying is like, no, both of those things have a very distinct place, but it's mm-hmm. a blend of both of those things yeah. together, which is so important.
Yeah.
It's not one or the other.
Right. It's like, to me, the terrain versus germ theory debate.
Yeah.
Right. I see a Venn diagram, a perfect intersection of the two. But there are some people that only want it to be one way, and there are other people that only want it to be the other way. And I don't know why that is. You know, I'm always looking to find, you know, I tell people all the time, I don't want to be right. You know, I'm just looking for the truth. I don't care to be, you know, the first, or, you know, I just want the truth, whatever it is. And on that path, sometimes it's a very winding road, you know? So sometimes I have to go down a whole rabbit hole to figure out I was wrong about something. Mm-hmm. But the thing about admitting that you're wrong about something is that now you know that you really don't have to, you know, consider that anymore. You've exhausted that possibility. So with terrain theory, I always think, okay, so what we want to do is, through nutrition and lifestyle, we want to support the organism, if it's a human, you know, as best as possible, get the immune system robust. We can impact the immune system. I mean, nutrient deficiencies have a major impact on the immune system. So that is terrain theory.
Yes.
If you and all your friends go out to dinner and you all have the same meal and one person goes home and gets food poisoning. I mean, I've had that experience before where we all have the same food, but only one person gets food poisoning. That's terrain theory, mm-hmm. you know? So why there's only one or the other is beyond me. I don't think it has to be that way. But I think that in my opinion, the pharmaceutical model needs to find its place because it has completely overtaken everything else to the point where I know doctors who say nutrition doesn't matter, which is mind boggling. Because again, when I drill down on that and ask them about simple biochemistry, they don't know, they don't understand. So to say that nutrition doesn't matter while simultaneously not understanding the biochemistry of human metabolism, that's a huge knowledge gap.
Yeah.
And so that's where I'm always trying to fill in the gap, right? So with doctors, I talk about more detailed biochemistry stuff. And with the public, I'll give them a little bit of that, but I also try to go, you know, the history of the food pyramid and, you know, the history of the dietary guidelines. And you know that it wasn't really all that evidence-based, and it's a very sordid past going all the way back to the Seventh-day Adventist church. It's a weird soap opera.
No one knows about this
and
either.
You got to know history so you can understand how we got here, mm-hmm. you know? So I think that's really important.
Yeah. The interesting thing, when I was listening to your 20-minute talk, you know, we'll call it the war on food, because I know you did a longer talk that same trip. It's so easy to hear the things you're saying about the Seventh-day Adventist Church and be like, oh, this guy's just a conspiracy theorist. Yet if you actually do your homework and go back, it's actually what happened. John Harvey Kellogg's, he was a protege of, what was her name?
Ellen Gould White.
And she had a vision from God, right, that she shouldn't eat meat?
Yeah, this is a super long story, so I won't go through the whole thing, but she was a co-founder of the Seventh-day Adventist. When she was 9 years old, she got hit in the head with a rock. She was unconscious for weeks. And when she woke up, she said that she was having visions of God. And God told her that in order for her flock to attain the rights to heaven, that they should avoid eating animal flesh. And also they should avoid things like wigs, corsets, and tight dresses. Just throwing that out there. And her protege was a young 12-year-old John Harvey Kellogg. Very impressionable. So he was writing for the church bulletin, but he was such a brilliant guy. He really was. That he ended up going to medical school, and Ellen Gould White and her family and the Seventh-day Adventists helped fund some of that. But he carried all of that with him, and he really believed that diet was the cure for what he called sinful behavior. So again, religious beliefs, you can have whatever you want, but when you start to enforce policy on the entire population based on someone's visions, which a lot of medical experts now think was essentially she was suffering from epilepsy, it becomes problematic. And we have to take a step back and just say, are we sure that this is all evidence-based? And then you can go further from there. One of John Harvey Kellogg's proteges was Lena Cooper, who went on, she was a nurse at the Battle Creek Sanitarium, which was the place that he ran that was a sort of mecca for wealthy industrialists and politicians. So that's how he started to gain a political foothold. Lena Cooper went on to found the American Dietetics Association. Mm. So now you see a direct line from Ellen Gould White, John Harvey Kellogg, Lena Cooper in the American Dietetics Association, which is now why everything they want is plant-based. And then if you move over from to a more modern nutritionist, Nathan Pritikin, most people know his name, the Pritikin Diet. He was a big fan of Ellen Gould White. And he said, he said something really funny. I read an interview with him where he said, she must have been divinely inspired because she had so much knowledge of nutrition, yet she had no training at all. And I thought, yeah, either that or she was wrong. Right?
Yeah.
But again, his pre-existing beliefs were vegetarian, low-fat, low-salt diets. And one of the people who was a big fan of his was Senator George McGovern. He used to attend Pritikin's diet camps. He dropped out early because who wants to eat a low-fat, low-salt, no diet? I mean, it sounds terrible. But they were such good friends that George McGovern, who was the head of the Senate Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs in the 1970s, who were addressing the dietary guidelines for Americans, he had Nathan Pritikin come and speak before the committee. They were such good friends that he gave Pritikin's eulogy in 1985.
He gave the eulogy in 1985.
So they were friends.
Wow.
And despite people's belief, they took 2 days of testimony on nutrition in the summer of 1976. And after that, one of McGovern's aides was charged with writing up the dietary guidelines. Now, there was a ton of protest. In fact, there were some great exchanges. You can even find them on YouTube. Exchanges between doctors and the senators who were running this committee. And they said, listen, we don't have the evidence to support making these dramatic. This is the first time the government is about to make these dramatic changes to the public and say, hey, we're gonna change everything about nutrition. And they were, they said, we plead with you to not make these recommendations right now until all the evidence is in. And McGovern actually said, the senator doesn't have the luxury that the research scientist does of waiting for all the evidence to come in before making decisions, essentially.
Yeah. They said they don't have the privilege of waiting, right?
Yeah.
And you would think, oh, maybe this would take weeks, months, even years for such an important recommendation.
Yeah.
48 hours.
Yeah, it was 48 hours worth of debate. And then after that, Nick Modern was the essentially the journalist who put together had to write out the guidelines. But he wasn't a scientist. So he went and found Mark Hegstead, who was a Harvard nutritionist, to actually help him with the science. And it, just a side note, Mark Hegstead also happened to be one of the nutritionists at Harvard that was paid off by the sugar industry to blame dietary fat for heart disease. So that's just an interesting side note that he was part of the actual construction of the guidelines. And then later on, the food pyramid came out. Louise Light was a nutritionist who was actually charged with taking those dietary guidelines and essentially putting them into a shape, so that they were easy to follow. And when she and her nutritionist colleagues put it together and they handed it back to the politician, she was horrified with the results because she actually said that this is going to create an epidemic of obesity and type 2 diabetes if we do this, because they essentially did things like putting all the grains on the bottom of the pyramid, and they just made this intensely high carbohydrate diet. And she said, that's not the pyramid that we handed the politicians, but the industry has a very powerful lobby. They got involved and everybody made concessions to the industry to try to, and this is what we've got. So we've got a food pyramid that doesn't really necessarily even resemble the evidence at the time. It was just something rushed. That Senate committee was actually originally tasked with undernutrition, malnutrition in the United States. But because in the 70s, essentially that had been eradicated, they said, well, before we go out of business, we might as well do something in nutrition. That was literally the sentiment of, I can read you quotes of some of these people. They said, we're going to go down in history. Yeah, you did.
You are. Not in the right way, though.
Right.
Yeah.
So, these historical facts, you can find them in the medical literature. You can read them for yourself. I use the term conspiracy theory, proudly, because that's also, people don't realize that the initials for conspiracy theory are CT, which is also the same initials for critical thinker, and that's really important to me, because to dismiss something as a conspiracy is to sort of eliminate thought. Mm-hmm. That's what I think it does. That term was essentially used to do that. It was actually used originally for the Kennedy assassination, to eliminate thought. Well, we don't want anybody to think for themselves. We'll just tell you what the answers are.
Mm.
And we've been struggling now with this chronic disease rate ever since. So as I said at the beginning of this, it's not that you can say the dietary guidelines are causal necessarily, but they certainly didn't help. And I believe they are partially to blame. And then we have all the foods that were added to the food supply and seed oils and things like this. But those low-fat dietary guidelines created a whole cottage industry of food manufacturers now manufacturing their foods to be low-fat. Mm-hmm. And adding all these other things to sort of make them fit this set of guidelines that were never evidence-based. But now you've got schools saying that you've got Cheetos that are school approved because they fit these dietary guidelines. I just wrote a story on this the other day.
Yeah.
Cheetos are school approved by the USDA.
But you can't legally sell whole pasteurized milk in a school.
No.
But you can get Lunchables as a lunch option. It's going to be 100,000 public schools or something like that.
Yeah,
Lunchables
is
going to be rolled out as an actual option.
I believe so, yeah. And New York is really, really bad for that. They just have really, they're, I know Nina Teicholz has done a lot of work on this, and but it's everywhere. And I think that has something to do with the C40 cities, New York being one of them. But there's just this top-down control. Remind me at the end of this, I would love to read you two quotes, one by Thomas Jefferson and one by one of the Dietary Guideline Committee members, just to illustrate how, where we, what the original intent of government and health was, and then what we've normalized today. But yeah, so there's this element of top-down control that I'm fighting against, because again, I just want people to have options, but it doesn't seem like the government is even interested in having people have options. It's just, this is the way it is. But yet you can go into California supermarket, and you can buy raw milk.
Makes no sense.
Right.
So California.
Right. Yeah. So in other words, right. So it's not a Democrat Republican thing.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that you would think if raw milk was so dangerous, yet I can go into a supermarket in California and buy raw milk, you should be seeing, you know, people dropping dead in aisle four all the time in California, but it doesn't happen like that. Yeah. So what's the problem with that over here? Again, why can't we give people the choice? That's all I'm advocating for. I just want the choice.
Yeah, as you've said many times, look, if you want to go plant-based or vegetarian, it's your prerogative, it's your right to be able to do that. If I want to eat meat because I'm trying to live the best possible life, I should be able to have access to that animal protein. And to your point, I think it would be great to dig into C40, because now it seems like, you know, if you live in certain cities, are you even going to have that choice to be able to buy red meat and animal products in the next 10 years?
Right. And I mean, to your last point, you are patient N of one, right? You ate an animal-based diet and cured a disease that was told to you that was incurable.
Yes.
I mean, how can anybody argue with that? It's unfathomable to me. And I've seen this too. You know, at the hospital, I had people reversing their type 2 diabetes, and I didn't have anything but nutrition, lifestyle, and then I could recommend supplements. Mm-hmm. And I had people drop their A1C down from 12% into the non-diabetic range, you know, to 5%, just with lifestyle changes. Mm. And doctors remain completely uncurious about how that, you know, to your point before. So these N of one experiences are very important. So I think, and I tell people all the time, just do the experiment on yourself. Mm-hmm. What do you have to lose?
Yeah.
I mean, you can eat Twinkies for 30 days. You can certainly eat red meat for 30 days and
just see what happens.
Right. What's the worst thing that could happen?
And that's the beautiful thing about this open sourcing of information, which gives me hope for the future, is like, now there's such amazing access where people are coming out of the woodwork and they're sharing their testimonials and their stories. Yeah. Yeah. So the average person that's like, oh, well, I've suffered from, you know, psoriasis for 10 years, but this girl is saying that she ate an all meat diet. She cured her psoriasis. If she can't do it, why can't I can do it myself. It almost like gives you that power of belief that we've never really had before. It's why anecdote is so powerful. But I guess that's a lot of the pushback too, is, oh, it's not a peer reviewed study. It's just anecdotal evidence that you're providing.
But that's where science starts, right? Yeah, with a hypothesis. That's the first step of the scientific method.
Yeah.
So that doesn't even hold water, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people just have this preconceived notion because of, there's a concept I recently came across called semantic satiation, where you take this phrase and you repeat it often enough. And again, we've all experienced this over the last 3 years. You take this phrase and you repeat it often enough that it actually loses meaning, to the point where now the meaning can become malleable. Mm-hmm. So saturated fat and cholesterol, people automatically have this predetermined reaction to it. Oh, it causes heart disease. Oh, it's terrible, you know, terrible for you. But then when I tell people that cholesterol is so important to the brain, that the brain makes its own cholesterol, mm-hmm. where cholesterol is 30% of your cell membrane structure, which mm-hmm. dictates function. Is cholesterol, are you sure that you should have your cholesterol at zero? I know cardiologists who have said that cholesterol should be zero. And I'm like, you understand that no cholesterol, no life. That's incompatible with life. Mm-hmm. But the dietary dogma around cholesterol and saturated fat is so deep mm-hmm. that I think people, when you say, well, I ate an all meat diet and you know, cured this, they think, well, there has to be some other mechanism. It can't be that, because meat is full of, you know, fat and cholesterol. Mm-hmm. So it's just, that's just another whole, I do approach things from a psychological element too, because I understand that people come to me with a lifelong programming that I have to unwind.
Yes.
Because that's so hard to do.
Oh, it's so hard. There's people, I remember when I first went carnivore, looking at the ribeye that I was going to eat. And I actually thought, is this going to kill me by eating this over and over again? Yet it was literally the key that unlocked my health and, you know, transformed me. And now it's why we're doing the show and building a business. It's changed. And it's like, it's all from making that one simple change. But what you also said, Jay, it's really interesting. You've almost seen this like progression of pushback from the other side, where it's like maybe like 20, 30 years ago when the Atkins diet was starting to get popularized, which is really just another version of low carb. It was, oh, you know, nutritionally, it's going to cause heart disease. It's going to jack up your LDL cholesterol. We've been disproving all that. Then the other side shifts to the environmental arguments. Regenerative agriculture disproves all that. And now it's like, nope, well, maybe the next thing is like suppression, C40 cities. It's been this like interesting progression from like nutrition to environment to like, okay, now we're just going to suppress these things.
Well, this is the moving of the goalpost. You're right. When they couldn't curb meat eating, although again, from the 70s in the sort of 80s in the institution of the dietary guidelines, red meat consumption has declined. But apparently not enough for some people.
Yeah.
And when they can't scare you with your own health, because why? Because when you continue to eat red meat and you don't have health problems, you're not going to believe that it's bad for you. Mm-hmm. So then they move to another argument. Well, it's bad for the environment. And, you know, we could go down a whole rabbit hole. In fact, yeah. I'm in the process of writing part two of a long Substack on meat and the environmental impact and just the general greenhouse gas concept as well. Because believe it or not, two papers were just published in 2017 and 18 in Nature, not just published, it was 5 or 6 years ago, that actually show the Earth over the last century has gotten 31% greener.
Wow, 31% greener.
Yeah. So and this article will be all cited. You can go to my Substack and read it. I've been excited just writing it because now it's giving me ammo when people come to me and say, you know, because I usually use the argument that, well, according to the EPA's own data, agriculture only contributes 9.4% of greenhouse gas emissions. So if you're concerned about greenhouse gas, it's only 9.4%. And of that 9.4%, 50% is crop, only 44% is animal. So wow. Crop agriculture is actually contributing more to greenhouse gases. The remaining is fuel combustion. But so that argument doesn't even hold water. And then if you take, and check this out, JAMA 2019, there was a paper published that said if you took the health sectors of the US, Canada, England, and Australia, they commit a combined 748 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalents annually. And if you took those health sectors of just those nations, they would rank seventh in the world in greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. So in other words, greenhouse gas emissions coming from industry and the healthcare industry specifically are a much bigger problem than animal agriculture. So mm-hmm. I would say if you actually want to curb greenhouse gas emissions, we need to be a healthier population. Mm-hmm. And how do we do that? We eat meat. Mm.
So interesting.
So that's how I usually approach it. But now I'm actually starting to see the evidence come out about the greening. Sub-Saharan Africa over the last 30 years has become 8% greener. Mm. I thought that was a good thing. Isn't that the whole environmental movement?
Yeah.
Right? So when you start to look at the actual published literature, you're like, wow. So these people aren't even telling you the truth about that. Mm. But I know you want to get to C40 cities, but I just wanted to throw that out there because if people are interested, that's coming and it's so fascinating.
Part two of this Substack article?
So I haven't even released part one yet because I just finished part one and I'm working on part two right now. It was too much information to keep. You know, I try to keep them to like around 1,000 words because, you know, I know people are busy. Yeah. But so the C40 cities, essentially that's a collection of mayors from around the world who are trying to get their cities onto this platform where they're going to make this whole sustainable, equitable future for everybody kind of thing. You know, again, semantic satiation. Those words start to lose meaning when you just throw them around all the time.
Exactly.
Especially when it comes. Yeah.
That's what I like to call it.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that. And they're into all kinds of sectors. They're into not just food, but aviation, construction, clothing, electronics, you know, so, you know, your home appliances, you know, I always make the joke, like, you know, what if one day you've eaten too much meat and all of a sudden your refrigerator won't open, you know, I mean, but these are the areas that they're involved in. And if you look on their website, I think it's c40cities.org, there's not a lot of literature out there aside from their website. So take it with a grain of salt because they're promoting it as the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Of course.
But that tracks with New York, where we are now, and Mayor Adams wanting to track meat and dairy purchases. And so that concerns me because the C40 cities is using the Eat Lancet model. And I think that allots 10 ounces of meat per week, which breaks down to about 1.5 ounces per day. So, I mean, I certainly eat more than 1.5 ounces per day. Mm-hmm. So what if one day I go in and my meat purchases are being tracked and I want to use my credit card to, you know, to buy a ribeye and my credit card has declined because I've gone past my carbon allotment for the week, the day, however they're going to track it. Mm. I mean, that's being tracked right now. And I just don't under, I don't think people understand that our data is so valuable, right? That's why they always say, if the product is free, you are the product, you know? And so data is very important. And that's why I've started to switch to purchasing a lot of food with cash. So because I'm a conspiracy theorist, but because I know they're tracking purchases.
It's not a conspiracy theorist. They are literally, tracking.
On the front page of the New York Post, you know, Mayor Adams is touting that he wants to track these food purchases. And I would love to have a sit down with him and ask him, where are you getting your information? Are you aware of this? Are you aware of that? I mean, look, let's face it. I just told you that the dietary guidelines were not evidence-based back in the 70s. The politicians have no idea what they're doing. Mm-hmm. They're doing the best they can. Some of them have good intentions. Some of them have bad intentions. But they are ill-equipped. They don't have the evidence. And so, you know, I just want the other side of the argument to be presented. I mean, who does Mayor Adams have himself surrounded with? I don't know. Maybe it's a bunch of ideologues. Maybe he's being controlled from the top down. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But all I know is that curbing meat and dairy intake, now these are some of the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet. So if you're really worried about population health, by removing access to these nutrient-dense foods, you might actually be hurting the middle to lower class population by not giving them access to the most nutritious foods possible, like eggs, like dairy, like milk and meat. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you really want to go back, you know, this is a little bit off topic, but still on topic, I think. I always go back to, do we ever know what to eat before dietary guidelines? Well, I'll say yes. E.B. McCollum was an American biochemist, and he coined the term protective foods. Mm. And so he had a list of protective foods that he said, if we just eat these, we'll be fine. And they were meat, fish, milk, eggs, leafy greens, and fruit. Mm. Now, and at his time, this is early 1900s, he's talking about raw milk. So it's not pasteurized. Mm-hmm. So I would amend that maybe today to say raw dairy, like kefir, yogurt, things like that. But imagine if people just ate from that list, meat, fish, milk, eggs, leafy greens, and fruit.
How much money would we save every?